from Tennessee, who got it on two levels of a hill.
During the assault on the hill, I was hit in the right leg four times by a Russian burp gun. When I was hit, I just dropped my rifle and started rolling back toward the bottom of the hill. And I got about halfway down and kind of got in a little rocky ravine-like, and so he opens up on me again, and I start rolling again. And I got to the bottom of the hill, and I had to hobble out by myself.
A Doughfoot from Charlie Company of the 38th Infantry, with a jaw too fractured to eat with, but serviceable for talking about how it happened.
I guess it was a mortar round that got me, because I didn't see any grenade land anywhere near us. And I got my fractured jaw and my cheek, and they got shrapnel on the side. Now, I don't remember much after that, but when I was laying there, after they bandaged me, I can remember all the bullets near right over our heads, and they had to move us back, but I guess they held off the position, and the next morning I woke up, and I guess they had really piled up the chinks.
Of the 68,000 names on the casualty list, 11,505 are dead. Of those still living, many are still fighting. Others are at evacuation hospitals, base hospitals, general hospitals in Taegu and Tokyo. And many are back at our great service hospitals here in the United States. And there are the amputees. This war, like the last, presents the problem of the amputee in his adjustment to civilian life. And we, flamboyant, unpredictable nation that we are, do things in extremes. There were two of those casualties in the news this week. One, a quadruple amputee in Walter Reed Hospital, who was presented with $120,000 raised by his fellow citizens. He is PFC Robert Smith of Pennsylvania, and he doesn't know what to do with that much money.
I want to thank the people who sent me gifts. I hear there's something like $120,000 in the kitty right now. That's a nice kitty. It books as well. When you're waiting for your arms and legs, don't think much of spending money.
And in Nashville, Tennessee, an 18-year-old veteran of that tiny army, which in July of last year held the Noctong River line, and now says he can't get a job in civilian life because he lost a leg in Korea. He has but one solution.
When I went home, I decided it's about time to go to work, so I went and applied for a job. I was told I couldn't get a job with them because they couldn't use amputees. I then decided I would get back into the Army. I liked the Army while I was in before, and from now on, the Army is my home.
There is an Army regulation that permits disabled veterans to serve in special jobs in the armed forces. For hour after hour, Monday through Friday, the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, sat before two Senate committees and answered questions. The Republicans in Washington long ago made it known that they were eager to question the Secretary. And this week, Mr. Acheson, through his testimony, revealed that he was eager to explain his policy. As he discussed our diplomatic activities and history from Iran around the world to Moscow, the Secretary attempted to answer one charge frequently made against him by Republican critics. The charge that we had sold out the Chinese nationalists to the communists. On this, Mr. Acheson was specific. The Yalta Agreement of 1945, which gave the Russians concessions in Manchuria, was the result of the desire by our military leaders to make certain of Soviet participation in the war against Japan. Chiang Kai-shek welcomed it. And Mr. Acheson said it had nothing to do with the later triumph of Red China. The Secretary placed the blame for the fall of the nationalist government on Chiang Kai-shek, his inept political and military leadership, and the lack of will to fight among his troops. And Mr. Acheson said that it was Chiang Kai-shek who originated the idea of working out a deal with the Chinese communists, a move that was supported by Generals MacArthur and Wedemeyer and Admiral Spruance. Mr. Acheson returns to the committee rooms tomorrow for his eighth day of testimony. In a less spectacular but perhaps more important battle now being fought in Washington, economic stabilizer Eric Johnston spoke about those who campaign against price controls.
Frankly, I think these people are afflicted with a mixture of astigmatism, wishful thinking, and a burning desire for business as usual, and at a time which is perhaps the most critical in all of our history. We're sitting on an economic time bomb. Business as usual has an ominous ring to me at a time when men are dying in battle in Korea for a free way of life.
President Truman was less pessimistic.
The government has tightened up on inflationary consumer credit and installment buying and is moving to restrain inflationary bank credit. The government has put price and wage controls into effect. These government actions, together with voluntary action by consumers and businessmen, have stopped the upward rush of prices. Since early February, when the general ceiling price regulation went into effect, wholesale prices have increased less than 1%. During the last month, they have actually declined. Consumer prices have leveled off and fruit prices have come down a little.
25 years ago, in June of 1926, Brown University awarded an honorary degree to the conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. A Russian refugee, incapable of expressing his gratitude in his adopted tongue, Serge Koussevitzky acknowledged his degree by playing a solo on the double bass. His original instrument was the double bass. Since his arrival in Boston in 1924, Dr. Koussevitzky's instrument has been the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He took the strings, the woodwinds, the horns, the percussion instruments, and welded them into what was one of the best musical organizations in the world. Yesterday, the string section of the Boston Symphony played for the maestro for the last time. In rites devoid of dirge and threnody, they buried him. And the string section of the orchestra he had loved and bullied into greatness played his favorite music, the Andante Cantabile by Tchaikovsky. A year ago, in one of his rare radio interviews, recorded at his home in Lenox near Tanglewood, Dr. Koussevitzky said this about his future and other jobs.
I give up the Boston Symphony Orchestra in Boston as director not to take your place. I don't want to have any responsibility apart from Tanglewood. Tanglewood, it is my child. It is my creation. It is my blood and tears. And Tanglewood I will never give up.
Two of America's five-star generals spoke this week. General Marshall to the class of 1951 at West Point. General Eisenhower on the beaches of Normandy on the 7th anniversary of D-Day. First, Secretary of Defense George Marshall reminding America's future generals about a basic American principle.
I think it is not the occasion, and it's a little too early, to comment on some of the difficulties you're going to have. There will be many. You will be misunderstood time and again. You will find it exceedingly difficult at times to compose the democratic procedures of this country with the military pattern which you feel to be necessary. But we're in a democracy, and I ask you never to forget that you are an officer in an army of a democracy. And only by your generous understanding of the position that an officer holds in a great democracy such as ours will lead you to a successful career. It is very necessary that you understand the workings of a democracy as applied to our military forces. I wish you the best of luck, and may God bless you.
On June 6th, General Eisenhower went back to have a look at the beaches he had once commanded, at the rusting hulks of ships and LSDs still lying offshore at Omaha and Utah, looked at the huge cemetery above the shelving beach, and drove again on the narrow roads between the hedgerows, and said,
"Citizens of a free world, the proudest the most precious title by which I can address you. It is a title that we could not use except for the men who sleep out in this field forever, except for men who, like them, lie in unnumbered graves throughout the world. Here in Normandy, it is particularly fitting that we commemorate the glory and the sacrifice of the liberation. For you were eyewitnesses, and your towns bear mute testimony to the tragic cost that must be paid to regain freedom once freedom has been lost. The young men of the Allied force who died in the hedgerows, their wounded fellows, those of your families and friends who fell in war, your ravaged homes and fields, all these are part of the price which we of the West have paid. Today, the West is united to defend freedom before freedom is lost. Freedom is not won and forever possessed. It must be re-earned every day and every generation.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for ear based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is WDWS-CBS in Champaign-Urbana. Follow the crowd. They're off to Pat Kane's, 202 North Neal in Champaign, for the big store-wide clearance end-of-the-season sale. Nationally advertised merchandise of winter and spring clothing, one-fourth off. What values? Top coats, suits, slacks, fur felt hats, long-sleeve sport shirts, and dress shirts with regular and French crops, one-fourth off. Shop at Pat Kane's tomorrow.
This is Program 26 on Hear It Now, a full-hour review of the week's news told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
A few minutes ago from Boston, you heard the sound of a great orchestra. Men trained for music, civilians with souls, artists combining their talents to transmit to others the inspiration of its creator. Goethe once said, "Every man hears only what he understands." Now we invite you to hear what you cannot understand. That is a possible instrument of destruction and death, tuning up, and now taking off. It is a guided missile. Just as the strings and woodwinds, the percussion instruments and the horns of a Boston symphony tell you something, the sounds you hear now, 46 different sounds, are telling something to a select few of America's top military scientists. You are listening to the firing of a rocket in New Mexico at the Army Ordnance Base at White Sands. We are permitted to describe it to you as a step toward the ultimate objective of having adequate guided missiles to do various practical missions for the Army. We believe you are listening to the prototype of a deadly weapon. We know that this rocket is fired from the ground, aimed at a target many miles away. It could be used to hit anything beyond the range of conventional artillery, troop concentrations, a warship, arsenals, cities. You are listening to the most modern military music, unheard by any soldier on any battlefield. But a step forward in designing a weapon to make the soldier's task simpler. These sounds may coincide with other sharps or flats you have heard, but they are not. You are listening to sounds that signify much to the scientist. These sounds, radioed from the rocket to the experts on the ground, are the sound of temperature and pressure, vibration and speed, heat and friction. 5 tons of rocket, with a half ton of instruments, are hurtling through space to tell the scientists in secret factories throughout the land that a new weapon of war is on the way, a surface-to-surface missile. It is steered by radar signals from the ground. Sometime in the future, it will lose its tinkling melody and its delicate theme. It will fly, if it must, over enemy lands.